Book of the Week with Claire Armistead on guardian.co.uk.
Hello, I'm Claire Armistead, and in this week's programme we have an interview with the best-selling novelist who has brought Rome back to life. We will be discussing the dying art of book editing with the publisher who is responsible for this year's Booker winner, Wolf Hall. We'll take a look at what will be on offer when Hay Festival comes to London. And if London or Rome aren't to your fancy, don't panic. We'll also be hitching a lift to the outer reaches of the galaxy with the writer who has brought Douglas Adams' creations back to life.
My challenge to myself was, if you can make these people escape in a way that's entertaining and unexpected, you know, then do the book. So when I came up with something that I thought worked at that point, that became for me the moment when I knew I was going to write the book.
Owen Colfer talking to The Guardian about And Another Thing, his sequel to The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. More on that later. But first, another author who is apparently unable to shirk a challenge. In 2003, Robert Harris embarked on the first of a trilogy of novels centred on the life of the Roman orator Cicero. The second volume, Lustrum, chronicles the years when Cicero was at the height of his power, consul of Rome, rubbing shoulders with the patricians while observing the rise of a womanising snake called Julius Caesar. Just before we hear from Robert, let's have a reading from the opening chapter of the book.
2 days before the inauguration of Marcus Tullius Cicero as consul of Rome, the body of a child was pulled from the river Tiber close to the boatsheds of the Republican war fleet. Such a discovery, though tragic, would not normally have warranted the attention of a consul-elect, but there was something so grotesque about this particular corpse, and so threatening to civic peace, that the magistrate responsible for keeping order in the city, C. Octavius, sent word to Cicero asking him to come at once. Cicero at first was reluctant to go, pleading pressure of work. As the consular candidate who had topped the poll, it fell to him rather than his colleague to preside over the opening session of the Senate, and he was writing his inaugural address. But I knew there was more to it than that. He had an unusual squeamishness about death. Even the killing of animals in the games disturbed him, and this weakness, for alas, in politics a soft heart is always perceived as a weakness, had started to be noticed. His immediate instinct was to send me in his place. "Of course I shall go," I replied carefully, "but..." I let my sentence trail away. "But," he said sharply, "but what? You think it will look bad?" I held my tongue and continued transcribing his speech. The silence lengthened. "Oh, very well," he groaned at last. He heaved himself to his feet. "Octavius is a dull dog, but steady enough. He wouldn't summon me unless it was important. In any case, I need to clear my head."
As you probably have gathered, nothing good is going to come of it. That was Robert Harris reading from Lustrum. And Robert is here with me in the studio. Could you explain to us who is the narrator of the story?
The narrator is Cicero's amanuensis, a real-life figure called Tiro, who was with Cicero for 30 years or so, and who Cicero wrote letters to him and described him as his support in all things, in his public life and his private life. And Tiro was really Cicero's fixer, and he long outlived his master, dying about 30 years later at the age of nearly 100. And he wrote a multi-volume life of Cicero. And when I came to try to imagine how I might write this trilogy of novels about ancient Rome, it occurred to me that I had my voice there, really, in Tiro, who's a sort of insider-outsider. He was a slave, and... but he was highly educated, and in ancient Rome often the slaves were, you know, very powerful figures. And it also enabled me to play off this figure, who is a slave, but who's very clever, with this master. And there's always a constant tension between them as to when exactly Cicero is going to set him free. But, of course, Cicero knows that Tiro knows where too many bodies are buried.
But also he's quite sceptical sometimes. He notices when Cicero gets too big for his boots and things, doesn't he?
Well, he's writing this book, as I imagine it, many years after his master has died. So he is free to bring the wisdom of old age and hindsight to this political political career. So yes, he's no man is a hero to his valet, no man is a hero to his political secretary either.
Now, there's a fascinating footnote to this, which is that we actually still have secretarial markings that Tiro invented.
Yes.
I didn't know this.
Well, this is an extraordinary thing about it. Tiro invented shorthand, effectively. He was the first to have an organised system of 4,000 characters, which was still in use in the Roman Catholic Church in the 5th century. And things like the ampersand, etc., NB, IE, these have come down to us through this Noto Tironi, as it was called, and they link us with Cicero's era. And Tiro almost certainly is the scribe who took down verbatim Cato's speech in the Senate, calling for the death penalty for the Catiline conspirators, which is actually, I reproduce in the book. I mean, he's the most wonderful voice, really. You couldn't make him up, as they say.
Mm-hmm. Now tell me, what is a lustrum?
A lustrum is 5 years, and every 5 years the censors in Rome used to clear out the Senate of the corrupt and the bankrupt, and there would then be a lustral sacrifice. So lustrum means 5 years. It also means an official sacrifice, and it has other meanings, the lair of a wild beast, or a brothel in plural, lustrum. So it's one of those wonderful words, and of course we also think of lust and of lustre. So it's a great word. Not one, actually, that I had discovered until very late on in the publication process when someone asked me to contribute a short story to a book of James Bond villains, and it was going to be called Lustrum. And I said, I can't contribute the story, but I wouldn't half like your title. And Fergus Fleming, descendant of the great Ian Fleming, said, OK, all right, you have it. The publishers say it isn't commercial in any case.
That is cheeky. So what made you think that Cicero, it's an old Roman orator, what made you think he was interesting enough to hold not only one novel, but a trilogy?
What happened was I wrote a novel, Pompeii, and when I came to finish Pompeii in 2003, Tom Holland's book Rubicon was coming out, and I read Rubicon, and I thought it was wonderful, and I was reluctant to leave the Roman period, and I'd always wanted to write a big political novel, having been a political journalist. And I'd fought shy of inventing a prime minister, and the reality was so bizarre, why would one try to invent another? And I thought, well, why don't I set my political novel in the Roman Republic, which had so many features in common with our own society? And I also thought it would be interesting to try and experience what Roman politics was really like. What was the Senate like? How many people were in it? Where did they all sit? How were debates conducted? How were elections fought, and so on? And the moment I started to do reading, it became obvious to me that the character that would most bring this alive was Cicero, who was very similar to our sensibility, it seems to me. He disliked cruelty. He disliked the games, for instance. He didn't like seeing animals tear one another apart. He always liked to defend rather than prosecute. He was a great upholder of law and order and civilized values, civis Romanus sum, legal protocol. And he was also a great writer, and his career was long, and he wasn't militaristic. And it seemed to me Cicero hadn't had a fair shake, really, that Caesar dominated so much.
Mm. So now the book's dedicated to Peter. Which Peter might that be?
Well, a guy who used to do our garden thinks it's him. But one of the attractions of just using a Christian name is lots of Peters can think it's them. But actually it is Peter Mandelson, who's been a friend of mine for 25 years, and from whom I suppose you could say I've received a political education. We've talked about politics a lot. I supported him when he lost office twice. He was very instrumental in enabling me to follow Tony Blair around in the 97 election. And it's thanks to Peter, really, that I've been given a ringside seat, or I was, of politics, which very few journalists get and almost no novelists. So, it's thanks to him that I've been able, I think, to see politics and politicians off duty. And it seemed appropriate to dedicate it to him, and not that I'm trying to say he is Cicero or any of the characters.
That is an interesting question, because one of Cicero's flaws, or his part of his downfall, is the purchase of a house that's outside his means. Is that a bit of an in-joke? Is that, are you teasing him a bit?
No, virtually everything that's in the book is actually accurate. And I hadn't thought, to be honest, of dedicating the book to Peter when I wrote the line. I don't know whether he's actually got to the line in the book yet. But it's true. I mean, it does happen to be the case that Cicero coveted this huge house on the Palatine with all the grand aristocrats and couldn't afford it. It was probably of cost 12 or 14 million sesterces, and he was given it for a knockdown price of 3.5 million by Crassus, the property millionaire in Rome. And it was the start of Cicero's undoing because, you know, he became heavily indebted. He needed to strike a corrupt deal with his co-consul Hybrida. And this whole deal started to unravel. And the lustrum, the first half of the book is Cicero in power, and the second part is how everything starts to go wrong once he leaves office. So that fell naturally. But I'm not trying to imply that Cicero is Peter, despite Peter's Ciceronian oration at the last Labour Party conference.
Let's just have another little reading to just show quite how it functions on a political level.
This is a classic, really, of just how politics worked in the Roman Republic, that Cicero, who inevitably had to suck up slightly to Pompey, the greatest military hero in Roman history, found himself having to go around and do Pompey's bidding, Pompey having returned from conquering the East, now hugely wealthy, wanting a settlement of land for his troops and all the dispositions that he'd made in the East ratified by the Senate. It fell to Cicero, as part of a political deal, to go down round and try and persuade all the patricians to accept this. And this is the way I describe it. And so Cicero put aside his distaste and his suspicions and did the rounds on Pompey's behalf, just as he had done years before when he was merely a rising senator. It was yet another lesson to me in politics, an occupation that, if it is to be pursued successfully, demands the most extraordinary reserves of self-discipline, a quality that the naive often mistake for hypocrisy. First, Cicero invited Lucullus to dinner and spent several fruitless hours trying to persuade him to abandon his opposition to Pompey's bills. But Lucullus would never forgive the pharaoh for taking all the credit for the defeat of Mithridates and flatly refused to cooperate. Next, Cicero tried Hortensius and received the same response. He even went to see Crassus, who, despite clearly wishing to destroy his visitor, nevertheless received him very civilly. He sat back in his chair with the tips of his fingers pressed together and his eyes half closed, listening to Cicero's appeal and relishing every word. "So," he summarised, "Pompey fears he will lose face if his bills don't pass, and he asks me to set aside past enmities and give him my support for the sake of the Republic." "That's it," said Cicero. "Well, I have not forgotten the way he tried to take the credit for defeating Spartacus, a victory that was entirely mine, and you can tell him that I would not raise a hand to help him, even if my life depended on it. How is your house, by the way?"
Ouch! You can feel the knife turning there, can't you?
Yes, and, you know, what has changed? Nothing at all.
So now, I wonder if you've thought at all about why it is that there seems to be so much Roman stuff around at the moment.
It is very interesting, and I think for a large part of the 20th century, after the First World War, through the rise of fascism, communism, into the Cold War, this blocked, obscured in a way, our view or our interest in the ancient world. I mean, of course, it was still there, but it was less there in popular entertainment. And that after the fall of the Berlin Wall and the so-called end of history and the rise of the single superpower, America, suddenly the parallels with ancient Rome seem more relevant, when there was just the one superpower, when there was a kind of settled agreement in the world. There was no ideological difference anymore. And the old spy thriller, the Cold War thriller, they fell away. And it seems to me that there has been a process of rediscovery, which seems to occur every century or so of the ancient world. And we're in that revival, as it were, at the moment.
And you could say you're leading that revival. Reviewing Lustrum in Saturday Review, Charlotte Higgins writes, Each generation makes its own Rome and its own Romans, and Harris's version of this endlessly fascinating figure is richly and generously enjoyable. I hope there is more to come. Is there more to come?
Well, that's very kind of her to say, and yes, there will be more to come. I'm going to write the third and final volume. I'm not going to do it immediately, actually, because I have an idea for a contemporary novel which I'd like to do next, just as I wrote The Ghost between Imperium and Lustrum. So I'm going to write a contemporary novel, and then I will face the technical challenge, really, of writing the third volume of this trilogy. Yes, which is the book that will be most crowded with incident, obviously, but also incident that is most familiar to readers, the assassination of Caesar and so on. But I'm looking forward to doing it. But I think it will be better for me to leave a year or so to go by so that I have to approach that novel, as I did this one, really, as an entirely standalone novel that has to have its own thematic unity. And, you know, I can't wait to do it, but I think it would be wise to just let the dust settle on the forum before I return to it.
Well, thank you very much for joining us, Robert. And Lustrum, the second part of the Cicero trilogy, is now published by Hutchinson and is available from guardian.co.uk/bookshop. Only a brave or foolhardy man would dare to take on the legacy of the man his fans knew as Bop Ad. But cometh the challenge, cometh the man, and that man is Owen Colfer, better known as the writer of the best-selling Artemis Fowl books for children. He has been licensed by the Addams Family to write the sequel to The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Well, earlier this week, The Guardian's Stuart O'Connor had the opportunity to speak to Owen Colfer, and he began by asking him whose idea it was to write And Another Thing.
Not mine. It was a project that came through Douglas Adams' agent and his widow. The series kind of ended, was left on a downbeat note, and Douglas wanted to end it more positively. Unfortunately, he died, so they thought for the 30th anniversary of the first book, there's massive celebrations planned all over the world, and a nice way to highlight that would be if somebody wrote a possible ending. It's not the definitive one, obviously, because Douglas didn't write it. So it's like a tribute book, if you know, a kind of authorized fan fiction. And so they came to me like that, and I initially was very doubtful. But then they said that they thought it would be a nice way to bring a new generation of people to the original books. So I agreed to do that.
The last book that Douglas wrote, Mostly Harmless, ended with everyone dead.
Yeah.
How big a challenge was it to get all the characters back to life?
Yeah, that was slightly difficult. But in another way, you kind of start with a clean sheet. For me, actually, that was a nice challenge to have. I like to have little puzzles like that. So my challenge to myself was, if you can make these people escape in a way that's entertaining and unexpected, you know, then do the book. So I thought about that for a few minutes, and I came up with something. So I thought, yeah, okay, this could work. You start off and you pretend you're going for the obvious thing, which is, say, Fudd Beeblebrox turns up in the Heart of Gold. And then you flip that at the last minute. So when I came up with something that I thought worked at that point, that became for me the moment when I knew I was going to write the book.
This is your first adult book. How enjoyable was that experience, and how different was it from writing the Addams Family books?
It wasn't very different. I mean, I thought, you know, maybe I'm going to have to somehow think harder or use longer words, but it didn't really work out like that. It was quite similar. And you have to remember that most people read Hitchhikers when they were 15. So it was a book that was hijacked by the teenagers. And most teenage readers by the age of 12 are reading all the books on their parents' shelf anyway. So I didn't really worry about that too much.
Owen Colfer talking to The Guardian's Stuart O'Connor earlier this week. Joining me now in the studio to discuss whether Colfer has succeeded, a science fiction blogger extraordinaire, Damian G. Walter, and Sarah Crown, editor of The Guardian Booksite. Welcome, both of you.
Hello.
Hi.
Sarah, first of all, what do you think of it?
He's been set an incredible challenge, and he really seems to have risen to it. The responses so far have been extremely positive towards the book, and it's such a difficult thing to do. You know, how to imitate without descending into pastiche or parody. And he really, really does seem to have an incredible ear for Adams's prose, and to have pulled it off, I think. So, you know, all credit to him.
Now, Damien, one of the things that was mentioned in that interview was that he's, having written for children, he's now writing for adults. Is Hitchhiker's Guide for adults or children, or for the child in the adult in us?
Well, I was saying, Sarah, to Sarah just before we came on, that I read it as a child. I read it probably, I think I was about 12 and 13 when I worked my way through the Hitchhiker's books. And I think they're... of that kind of writing, I would put them there with Terry Pratchett as well, of someone who's using a vast amount of humour and wit and very intelligent ideas in their writing, but is writing in such a simple, maybe an elegant way, that readers of all ages can engage with it. And that's one of the real strengths of Hitchhikers. I think that's why it was such a successful piece of literature, because there's this massively broad audience that can engage with what are actually very complex ideas because of the simplicity of the presentation in the book. So I think it's interesting for Owen Colfer as well, because yes, he does write for children, but the Artemis Fowl books are also very intelligent. They're also very witty. So I think if you were to have not told me who was going to do it, he might have been one of the names I might have picked for
that's
it.
Interesting.
He's clearly a big fan as well.
So, Sarah, just bringing you back to the idea of sequels, is this a valid form of literature? There seem to be an awful lot of them at the moment.
Yes, it does seem like we're in the middle of a bit of a flurry of them. There's the Winnie the Pooh, the new Winnie the Pooh book. Sebastian Faulks wrote a new James Bond book, Devil May Care. And we've had people like Geraldine McCoughran, who wrote Peter Pan and Scarlet, which was a sort of a sequel to J.M. Barrie's novel. So I suppose, yes, we're seeing a lot of it right now. I mean, it is something that has happened in the past, that people have returned to, revisited other people's work. But whether or not it's a good thing, a useful thing, or a worthwhile thing to do, I think depends entirely on who's doing it and how well they do it. And in Colfer's case, he's obviously been successful. In Sebastian Faulks' case, I think the consensus was that he was probably less successful. Again, perhaps because we sort of have that boundary between parody and imitation. And he really went for it with James Bond and brought in all of the stuff, you know, the casual racism and sexism, for example, which you kind of think if Ian Fleming had been around today, he probably would have moved past that. And you know, it was very much of the time without being something that needed to be picked up in a modern adaptation.
Mark Lawson, reviewing And Another Thing in The Guardian Review this Saturday, describes it as the best post-mortem impersonation I have ever read. Now, there is high praise indeed. And Another Thing, Douglas Adams' Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, Part 6 of 3, now that's a very Adams title, is out now and it's published by Michael Joseph. This year's Booker chairman, Jim Naughtie, chose to use his position to berate publishers for the parlous state of editing that he'd experienced during his stint ploughing through all those dozens of Booker submissions. But can too much editing be a bad thing? William Golding certainly had his beefs, and here's John Carey telling me on the Books podcast a few weeks ago how Golding resented the way his editor Charles Monteith took the religion out of Lord of the Flies.
He did protest at first, but he did give way entirely, and he says in letters before the book is published, he says, "I can't believe I wrote this book. You've done such wonders with it. It's far better. You've taught me to be economical," and so on and so on and so on. And that is what he mostly felt, but I found that when he was in India, towards the end of his life, it would be in the late 80s, he was talking to an Indian group of Indian students. There he says, "I gave way too easily." And when he wrote his last novel that he was still writing when he died, it's about a priestess at Delphi who is managed by someone who is clearly Charles Monteith, and who tries to get this priestess to misrepresent the sayings of Apollo, the god, as it were, rewrite Lord of the Flies, leaving out the religious part, you know? And she won't. She won't do it. So, you know, he, A, did come to regret it, and B, wrote a book about it where he stands up to Charles.
With all this in mind, for our interview with Robert Harris earlier, I read Lustrum with one eye out for the howlers. And I have to report that I didn't find a single one. However, we on the Guardian Books Desk are remorseless in our pursuit of the truth. And so we have dragged into the studio one of the leading editors of today, Nicholas Pearson, publishing editor of Fourth Estate, and the man behind a string of winners, including Jonathan Franzen's The Corrections and two of this year's Booker Books, Me Cheater, and of course the winner, Wolf Hall. Congratulations, Nicholas.
Thank you.
Wolf Hall's a very big book to edit.
Well, it was initially conceived as one project, as one book. And 2 years ago, there were some decisions to be made when the book was getting bigger and bigger and bigger. All these decisions were made by Hillary. She could see a way of doing it in two, and all she wanted was from me was reassurance that she was making the right decisions, which she was.
Do you think that there's any truth in what Jim Naughty has to say?
I'm sure there is. From experience, I would say that some of the books that look least edited are most edited.
So why is that?
Because it's a process. To a certain extent, I'm going to get in terrible trouble for saying this, that there is a sort of bit of a factory element about it. We commission books. Some books come in and they're even better than we thought they were going to be. Other books come in and they're not quite as good as we think they were going to be. And we try and get the books to be as good as we possibly can when we finally have to say enough, put a cover on them and put them out in the shops.
Do you ever find that your job just doesn't permit you to spend the hours that you would like to spend?
It gets harder. When I first started in publishing, I worked at a very big and famous imprint. And there were rooms full of readers, copy editors, editorial assistants. It was unbelievable. And now that same place, which I have to say is thriving and publishing some of the best stuff around, is a tiny little team. So time does get more precious.
Sounds a bit like journalism, Sarah, doesn't it?
Yes.
Have you noticed any particularly badly edited books recently?
Well, I was thinking about this when we were talking about this earlier on, and I wondered whether Jim Naughty, when he was talking about it, was referring to copy editing rather than editing. So when he's talking about a fall in standards, what I assume he's referring to is typos, things like that, and really, you know, it's just not that big a deal, I think. You know, they occasionally creep in. We can all live with that and move on, I think. In terms of editing, what I think personally is the worst example of bad editing is when people don't edit enough. And probably the best example of this in recent times, and a very well-known one, is J.K. Rowling, who started off writing three taut, neat, well-constructed, concise books. She hit book three, it all blew up. And then they just become these sprawling edifices where you can feel the editors having taken their hands off the wheel and said, you know, you just go for it. Whatever you want to put out, the more words, the better. Brilliant, brilliant. Such a mistake, I think.
Fabian, you come at it from the other side. You've written for magazines, SF for magazines, and
sure.
And you're working on your first novel. What's been your experience of editors this far?
Well, I always try to, because I'm publishing on quite a small level in sometimes fanzines, but larger publications as well. I'm always trying to find the most interesting and creative editors to work with, because I feel I'm a writer who's still trying to find my voice in some ways, and the editorial feedback I get from editors is really, really useful to that. So I'm really interested in maybe why isn't it that editors aren't recognised and rewarded more for what they're doing? Is there not an editorial prize of any kind?
Well, I mean, what I would say is that books are sold to, on the whole, this is in some ways a terrible generalisation, books are sold to publishing houses in a very different way. It seems to me that agents, on the whole, they have a book, they'll put it out there to every Tom, Dick and Harry in London. They don't seem, many of them, necessarily interested thinking, oh gosh, I can see what this writer's trying to do, and I know this editor over there who might respond to it and be able to help this writer with what he's trying to do, or she. It's money. Often.
Now, a couple of moments ago, we heard John Carey talking about William Golding's reservations about his editor. And a more extreme example has just come to light with the republication of a collection of short stories by Raymond Carver in their original form. That is to say, before his notoriously ferocious editor Gordon Lish got his hands on them. The collection's been renamed Beginners, though Carver fans will know it as What We Talk About When We Talk About Love. And they'll particularly know about it because it was Robert Altman's Shortcuts. Sarah, what do you make of this? I gave you some homework, which was to read one of the most famous stories and do a sort of Pratt-Crit comparison.
The story that you asked me to read was called A Small Good Thing, and it appears in the original collection, What We Talk About When We Talk About Love, as The Bath. And I think it was, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it was a story that one of the ones that Carver produced a revised version of during his lifetime. So he actually got to see it sort of in the form that he'd originally conceived of it. But it is the story of a woman, a mother, whose son on his birthday is knocked over by a car in a hit-and-run accident. In both versions, it's an incredibly gripping story. But it is a different story, although the bones of it are the same. The sense of it, the feeling of it, the emotions behind it are completely different. So in Carver's original version, we have one with fleshed-out characters, motives more examined, emotions much more deeply examined. In The Bath, it's exactly what we think of Raymond Carver being. It's pared back, it's still and fierce and very enigmatic and ambiguous and a brilliant piece of writing, you know, and for my money, a better piece of writing, but perhaps not as good a story. So to answer the question, I don't know if you could say one is better than the other, but they're very different. I'm not quite sure where that leaves us. But
you have to say which is better. Oh. You're on the fence.
Okay, I can say which one I like better. And I could say that I probably prefer the unedited one because I'm a bit of a sap. And it absolutely plugs into that. You know, you feel a lot more for the mother. You feel a lot more implicated in the story. So I liked that one better, but I think that the other one is a better piece of writing.
In a funny sort of way, maybe that Carver-esque staccato writing was of its period. I mean, it's that mid-century, mid-20th century, isn't it?
Well, I think his writing has been massively influential. There's a short story form at the moment, the flash fiction, which is the 1,000 word or less story. And they're very, very popular, particularly in the internet age. And you can see on websites, and you hear them on podcasts as well, that Carver is a massive influence over the writers who are working on those, because he developed all these narrative techniques for distilling a story down into its absolute essence. But then you ask, was it Carver who developed those techniques, or was it the relationship with his editor as well?
I've read a little bit about this, and it's very sad to me that this is all happening, and what are we doing? We're talking about lish. I mean, editors should be invisible.
Have you ever felt that, you've ever interfered with, you've made a writer's style by your interferences?
No, I haven't, and I will put my hands, I've done things editorially which I regret.
Can you give us examples?
No. Absolutely will not give you any examples at all. But of course I have regrets about, and one or two things in particular.
Well, I have to say that Blake Morrison in The Guardian Review says, the true Carver we now see is gentler, fleshier, less brutal than Lish's Carver. So I do think that it's one that, if you're a student of literature, it's a fascinating case study. I would recommend that you read this, if only to make the comparison and have those thoughts. However, Nicholas, this brings us into interesting territory for you as the man who actually came up with the idea of Me Cheetah, which people who have been following the Booker Prize will know was long listed for the Booker and is the autobiography, or was originally published as the autobiography of the Tarzan chimp, without a byline at all for its actual author.
Yes. Well, look, I'll tell you straight, it was me on the Google button finding out too much about that blooming chimpanzee in the Tarzan movies and thinking, wouldn't this be a bit of fun to publish his autobiography, and thought of it as a bit of trashy autumn publishing, if you like, on some level. Then I happened to bump into a fellow who was pitching some books at me about the Olympics, and my eyes were, even though I'm a sports nutter, were falling to the back of my head. And it, almost to keep the conversation going, I threw in the cheetah idea. And the rest is history. You know, I happen to have stumbled across, in my view, one of the great literary talents that I've come across in the last few years.
What's his name?
James Lever. Mm-hmm.
So is it your book or his book?
Oh, God, it's absolutely his book. And I don't pretend, when we published it in hardback, we published it as a little bit of a stunt.
Now, last but not least, we turn to the latest project of Hay Festival impresario Peter Florence, which is to run a weekend of events in the Guardian's own home, King's Place. The theme is the literature of London, and the lineup includes Will Self, Faye Weldon, Hanif Qureshi, Charlie Higson, Martin Amis. Sarah, did any of these particularly catch your eye?
Well, actually, the one that I was going to mention was Meg Rossoff, who's come to talk about her book, The Bride's Farewell, which isn't a London book, nor is it even a city book, but I really enjoyed it, and I think she's a great speaker, and she has quite a good relationship with Hay. So I'm definitely looking forward to that. But on the London note, I thought there's the big sort of headline 7 p.m. Saturday event with you, Claire, and John Sutherland and Peter Florent, who are talking about the writing of the city, so Dickens and Trollope and Amis and Virginia Woolf and Zadie Smith and so on and so forth. And that will be, I think it's a very interesting subject and one that I look forward to hearing.
And
explored.
Will Self, Damien, has quite a following amongst SF fans, doesn't he?
He certainly does, yes. He's one of those writers who crosses from satire into SF and that borderline between the two.
So he's the one you'd be checking out, were you to be in London that night, which I hope you will be.
I'll be trying to come down for it, yes.
Hay at King's Place runs from Friday the 23rd of October to Sunday the 25th. To see the full programme and book tickets, go to www.hayfestival.com. And that's all for this week's podcast. Thank you to our studio guests, Damien G. Walter, Nicholas Pearson and Sarah Crown. I'm Claire Armistead and the producer is Scott Corley. Goodbye.